pretty much any time you step outdoors and go for a little walk or whatever, you're going to hear some birds singing. How often can you put a name to that song or that bird, or even if you see that bird, how you identify it? It isn't always a straightforward process, but tell you what, our next guest is here to help. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Brian Sullivan. He works on eBird and digital publications at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and he's conducted field work on birds throughout North America for the past 25 years, so he's had a lot of experience with it. And he is the co-author of Peterson Guide to Bird Identification in 12 Steps, and we'll be talking about that today. He shares some great advice that you can put to use immediately. And as always, we welcome your questions at 1-800-642-1234. How are your bird identification skills? What tips and tricks can you share with us? Call in now, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Brian Sullivan, thank you for joining us today.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, I really, really appreciate you taking time to be with us today, and I really enjoyed your book. Maybe you can just go ahead and make the case that bird identification is something worth learning in the first place.
Well, sure. I mean, people see birds every time they're outside, and birds are, you know, sort of, I think, amazing windows on nature. I think they're the only organism out there that we can observe sort of readily every day and hear, and they're part of our lives. They raise their young in our backyards and migrate through and breed and use our planet in different ways than we do, but we're sort of constantly connected with birds, and I think that it's pretty hard to ignore their beauty and their presence on the planet. So a lot of people are interested in birds, and this book is really meant to sort of demystify the bird identification process and make it more accessible and understandable to someone who might be interested in picking it up.
And, you know, as I looked through this, I thought, well, for somebody who's a pure novice, this is going to be extremely helpful. But I think even veterans of birding can benefit from this.
Yeah, I mean, the book is really written for birders of all skill levels. And I think that we try to break it down into sections that are digestible. And we oftentimes, I think people will pick up a bird identification book, meaning a field guide, and the book has anywhere from 600 to 900 species treated in it, and they don't know where to start. And they end up just sort of looking at the bird and trying to match the picture in the book with what they see, and that can be very difficult, especially if you're not close enough to the bird or you don't know what to look at. You're not considering other things that make bird identification actually a lot easier than it might seem.
Yeah, I was thinking about talking. I was talking with somebody the other day, or maybe it was on this show, about cardinals, which I always love the song of a cardinal, and it's sort of a favorite song. But I know this time of the year when I hear the cardinal, I go take my eyes right up to the top of the trees, because the cardinals, at least in this area, are always pretty much as far to the top of the tree as you can get, and we don't have leaves on the trees right now, or they're just forming, so that's where you spot them.
Yeah, in Wisconsin right now, you're just approaching the peak of spring migration for eastern land birds, and cardinal is a resident breeder there. Cardinal doesn't migrate, but you are right now seeing all of the wood warblers move back through, and it should be a fantastic time to get out and go birding and hear a lot of different birds.
It definitely is. I love getting up early in the morning around sunrise and getting out, and that's when they're really cranking it up around here this time of the year. It's really a lot of fun. Well, we'll take some calls and we'll get to Forest and Park Falls in just a minute, but I like to go through the framework of your book, and your first step is an important one, taxonomy. And that's really, you say it's the fundamental basis to birding. Can you define what you mean by taxonomy and how it sets the stage for everything else?
Well, taxonomy is something that people tend to ignore or sort of gloss over or glaze over when they think about taxonomy in birds. And the reality is that taxonomy is simply an order by which we name birds, and those birds are related to each other. And I think it's pretty easy if we showed people a picture of a hummingbird or a picture of a swan, they'd be able to distinguish one from the other. Even though those birds are related, they're distantly related, and there's a whole lot of species in between. And taxonomy is simply the ordering of those birds from the most primitive to the most evolved form. And, understanding taxonomy can really help a birder understand how groups of birds behave and how they look. For example, warblers all share certain features that make them warblers. And those features include bright plumages and, short, relatively pointy bills, whereas vireos, which might look similar when you sort of flip through a field guide, have different kinds of features that are shared, including blunt, sort of thicker bills with little hooked tips. And those kinds of things, just learning those differences at the higher levels in these groups of birds can be really, really helpful. The behaviors are shared among those groups. And, all of the things that we sort of talk about in this book, by the time, if you look at the structure of our book, most people would be surprised that you have to get to step 10 before you get to plumage. And yeah, plumage might be one of the most obvious things to think about, but there's a lot that you can do before you even have to look at a bird's plumage.
And I have to say that your book, along with some beautiful bird photography, but your book is really well written, and written at a level and in a fashion that is fun to read and easy. It was easy for me to understand. So I'm assuming that if I can understand it and enjoy reading it, most anybody else can as well. So I have to applaud you for that.
Well, thanks. My co-author Steve Howell is a prolific writer, and this book is, I can hear Steve Howell's voice in my head when I read this book, because he's a great conversationalist, and I think he's really set the tone for this book to be approachable and understandable by a variety of levels of birder.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's go to Forest and Park Falls. Let's go there first. Hi, Forest. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Great show. This spring, when we had that big last snowfall that we had, there was very little ground cover open, and we saw a small bird, similar in size between like a sparrow, or a little bit bigger than a sparrow, not as big as a robin, and it was totally black, but it was a flat black, and it had short legs, but it had a beak like a woodcock or possibly a sandpiper. But, it didn't have the long legs of a sandpiper. Any idea what kind of a bird that might have been? It was totally black. No white belly or nothing.
But with a woodcock-type bill, did you say?
A woodcock beak or a sandpiper beak, or, like a hummingbird. It was real, real short beak. He was probing the ground around our bird feeder, and it really caught us by surprise. We grabbed a bird book instead of the camera, But we couldn't find it in Bird Book.
And when did you see this again?
This was probably 3 weeks ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's a migrator.
Yep.
Possibly. Wow, I don't know, Brian. That might be hard to figure out.
Yeah, I mean, there are anomalies out there, and one of the chapters in our book is called Variation. And the thing that you're describing doesn't sound like any bird that I'm familiar with, and it makes me wonder if it could have been something like a blackbird, cowbird, or something like that with a really deformed bill. I mean, sometimes birds do have these extreme bill deformities where something just goes haywire and they grow a really long upper mandible, and things just go wrong occasionally. And those aberrations can really throw birders off. It's really hard to ever treat those in a field guide. But, you know, a lot of guides do talk about the fact that these things occur. Sometimes birds are melanistic. Sometimes they're leucistic, which means they have a sort of dilute pale plumage where they're mostly whitish. All of these things happen, and they can really throw birders off. But what you describe doesn't ring a bell for me in terms of anything that should be occurring in Wisconsin.
Yeah, me too. Next time, get the camera out or get your phone out and get a photo of it. I would love to have seen that one myself. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Kim and Ladysmith, let's go to you. Hi, Kim.
Hi. I try to listen for a type of a bird, and I hear the bird before I see it, and I'll give you guys a little quiz to see if you know what bird it is, okay?
All right.
It goes, oh, sweet Canada, Canada, Canada. You guys, can you get it?
What do you think, Brian?
Carolina Wren? Canada.
Carolina Wren?
It's a type of sparrow.
Oh,
that would
book,
be.
It'll say
white-throated
kind of
sparrow.
Yes, you got it. It's really fun because I drive my friends nuts once I see them, and I keep on singing that. Oh, sweet Canada, Canada, Canada. So I just thought maybe we have some fun with it. So.
Kim, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, and of course, sound is a part of your book as well.
Yeah, learning to identify birds by sound is really difficult, and it's step 8 in the book. And I think, you know, the main thing with learning birds by ear is really focusing in on learning the common birds in your yard, starting with, you know, the cardinal that's always in your treetop, the white-throated sparrows on migration that are singing. These are great birds to sort of practice detecting birds by ear and then associating those sounds with the correct identification. Now, I would say that once you get to a certain point with birding by ear, you can probably do 90% or more of your bird identification just by ear. So when I walk my dog around the block in the morning in my neighborhood, I know every bird sound and every individual even on that loop so that I'm completely dialed into their calls so that if something different like a migrant warbler or finches or whatever fly over, those stand out as different right away. And that's how you really start to build your birding by ear skills.
And I had someone call the show one time and say that they get out their bird songs that they have on recorded early in the year, and they sort of listen to those songs again to sort of retune themselves so they can, oh, yeah, that's what they sound like kind of thing. And I think that's not a bad idea.
No, it isn't. And, you know, we at the Cornell Lab, we have a bunch of resources that can help with that. One resource that we make available for free for birders is a mobile app called Merlin Bird ID. And Merlin Bird ID is basically an app that uses the distributional information that we gather through eBird, and it limits your choices to the birds around you and allows you to practice, you know, looking through pictures, listening to sounds. It even has algorithms that allow you to say, you know, what you're seeing, and it helps you identify the birds.
You know, we're going to take a quick break, Brian, for the news, and then we'll be back with him and we'll talk some more about birds. You stay with us. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about bird identification on the program today, and our guest has an easy framework for helping amateur and expert birders alike, I think, better identify and appreciate the birds around us. Brian Sullivan is the co-author of the Peterson Guide to Bird Identification in 12 Steps. And he's sharing those steps with us today. So questions that you might have, I hope you'll join in. How do you identify birds in the wild? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Or go ahead and post your question or maybe your bird photo on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Love to see that as well. And Brian, one of the... I'm not sure that you finished what you were talking about there just as we were breaking. But
I was talking about the Cornell Labs Merlin Bird ID app, which is basically designed to help you identify birds, and it's a mobile app that, you know, uses information from eBird to figure out what birds are most likely around you, and then it helps you step through a process to identify the bird. And it can even identify bird pictures that you take with a high degree of accuracy. So I just wanted to point that out for listeners to check out that app, which is available for iPhone, Android, and all that stuff.
And what is the app name again? Because somebody's going to say, wait a minute, what was the name of that app?
Yeah, the app's called Merlin Bird ID.
Merlin Bird ID. Okay.
Yep.
You know, along those lines, and you may remember this, CBS Sports was, and this goes back several years now, they were hosting or showing the Masters Golf Tournament. And there's these serene photos of the course and so forth. And there were bird sounds in the background. And suddenly CBS was getting all kinds of irate emails from birders because they were playing bird songs that were not from birds you'd find in that location. And they had to issue a kind of a formal apology for just dumping in any old bird song. Do you remember that?
I do remember that, and unfortunately that's the case still with pretty much any show that you see that's not a natural history documentary on television or in the movies, but they have a habit of just finding bird sounds that are cool and piping them in, and with no regard for sort of the location or date or, you know, season, any of those things that come into play when, you know, in determining what birds are likely in an area. And it's not uncommon to have some tropical rainforest, you know, scene with a common loon going off in the background.
Well, location, and step two in your book is location, as a matter of fact. And this is sort of an underlying base that experience birders often take for granted and beginners maybe don't pay enough attention to.
Yeah, as I was saying before, a lot of the initial impulse, I think, with birders is a visual one. And they look at the bird and they pick up the field guide and they want to immediately match the bird with what they think, you know, they're seeing in the field guide. And they forget about the little things that are off to the side, which are the range maps. Those range maps really are important, and those maps will tell you whether that bird is likely where you are and whether it's likely on the date. You know, if there's two things that you know that are sort of easy to figure out, it's where you are and what the date is. And those things are incredibly important for say, birding in Wisconsin. You don't see, you know, all of the wood warblers that are arriving now. You know, those leave by September, early October. You don't find those in Wisconsin anymore. So if you see, you know, a bird that has a certain set of features in the winter, you can assume that it's not one of the wood warblers, or at least you shouldn't start there. You should start with something more likely, like one of the more colorful finches or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's take some calls. Kay and Prairie du Chien, it's your turn. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Okay, I have seen so many different birds evidently immigrating through this one area when the water's high like this. It's a kind of a woodsy, very brushy, and everything. Well, I've seen those little ruby kinglets, the two different ones.
Oh, you know what, Kay? I'm not able to understand you. You might be going through a bad patch. Why don't you try calling again, and we'll try to get you on again. So we'll take you off now, and we'll instead go to Eric in Oshkosh, and hopefully you can get back on. Eric, what's on your mind?
Well, I was just looking out my window at work, and I saw a robin, and it looked like it had two yellow feathers on its wings, but in closer, it could have been like tags. I guess that was my question. Would there be like little yellow tags sticking out from under a robin's wing, and is that something that's possible?
Brian, birds are often tagged in certain ways. What do you think?
For robins, most likely they wouldn't have wing tags because they're so small, their wings are so small that the kinds of tags that they put on birds' wings wouldn't really fit there. Robins would have, if they were banded, they would have a leg band and maybe a color band on the legs. But I don't know of any cases where people are wing tagging small birds like robins, but bigger birds like red-tailed hawks and eagles and things like that often carry these what are called patagial tags that clip over the leading edge of the wing. But yeah, I'm not aware of that for robins.
Interesting. So it's a mystery on that one, Eric.
It was a yellow triangular looking possibly feather, but I've never seen any kind of color like that on a robin before, but I'll try to get a picture if he comes by my window again.
Yeah, I'd love to see that. Thanks, Eric, for calling. Let's go to Carolyn in Oshkosh next. Hi, Carolyn.
Hello.
What's on your mind today?
Well, my simple solution personally to identifying birds is I follow the song to the bird. And then if I can't identify the bird, I look in a bird book. I'm like a black-capped chickadee. I finally found out who was making that whistling sound, that little and it was a black-capped chickadee. And I didn't know what was making that whistling sound until I followed the song to the bird.
Ah.
Yep, that's the best way to learn birds by ear. Hear the bird, track it down, and see the bird. And you will remember that making those connections so that the next time you hear that call, you'll know, oh, that's a black-capped chickadee, and I don't have to track it down and see it. And that's how you begin to be able to identify a large proportion of birds by ear, and then you can focus your visual attention on other things.
I like that. Thank you very much, Carolyn. Well, Carolyn, listen to this, and Brian, listen to this bird song, and I bet you're going to be able to figure this one out. Huh? That's a bird that just arrives in Wisconsin, at least in my home, pretty much every year on May 4th.
Is that a rose-breasted grosbeak?
No, it's a Baltimore Oriole.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah, and that's one of those time things. You start listening for that song here in Wisconsin around May 1st. And there's one that comes around to my feeders. My grape jelly and orange have spots on almost every year on May 4th, which is kind of a...
Yeah, birds are amazingly predictable in their timing when it comes to migration. If you look at resources like eBird, which is, again, a tool that's built for birders by the Cornell Lab, and you can get on there and pull up what we call seasonal bar charts for any location in Wisconsin and see that those orioles and grosbeaks and all the migrant birds tend to arrive within a very small window every year. Sometimes there's local differences if the weather's been exceptionally cold, but a lot of the longer distance migrants do arrive within a few days every single year.
We have, by the way, you can join in too with your questions. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. You talk about habitat as another one of the steps. And this is different from location in a lot of ways, but yet they kind of go hand in hand when identifying, don't they?
They do, yeah. And, you know, the habitat a bird is in can be anything from large-scale habitats, like, you know, whether it's in a marsh or a coniferous forest, or it can be even in a spruce. Is all about limiting your likely choices. So when you've got that book that has 900 species in it, how can you get that down to a reasonable few to really focus on and worry about? And that's really why we've started this book with, you know, the major things that help you limit your choices quickly. So location and habitat easily help, you know, get rid of a bunch of options right off the bat.
Yeah. Here's another song I like to, a song I of a, I guess you could call it a song that I like to hear. Oh, that's a great song, a great sound that we enjoy hearing. And we hear a lot more of those sandhill cranes now than we used to hear 10 years ago, Brian.
Yeah, that's great. It's such a beautiful sound. Sandhill crane is a fantastic bird. It's one of the earliest returning birds in migration. We have a project that we run at the lab called the Great Backyard Bird Count, and that runs in mid-February, and every year we can see the tracks of returning sandhill cranes coming right up through your area, right up from, you know, the western birds coming from New Mexico up to the Platte River. They're on the move at that time already.
Let's go to Ellen in Waupun next. Hi, Ellen. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Thank you for this wonderful program. And as I was listening, I looked out my window, and on my bird feeder post, I have the orange and the grape jelly and a feeder. I had four Baltimore Orioles, and then a bluebird flew in to join them. It was such a delight, and it's rare for me to get that kind of sight in my own yard.
Oh, that's wonderful. And bluebirds, I never see them at my feeders, unfortunately. There's the color of a bluebird, Brian, is just unbelievable to me.
Yeah, they are stunning birds. The neat thing about that color on bluebirds is that, you know, there are a couple of different species of bluebirds. In Wisconsin, obviously, you have eastern bluebirds, but out west we have western and mountain bluebirds as well, and they're all this incredible shade of blue above, and they're subtly different. I think the eastern bluebird might be the prettiest of them.
Well, Ellen, you're lucky. You got three or four Baltimore Orioles and a bluebird. That's got to be great. You should get a photo of that.
I hope I can.
Thank you. Thanks a lot for calling. Oh, man. John in Oshkosh.
Hey, Larry. Great show.
Thanks.
Got a question for your guest. Outside my backyard, I have a wooded backyard, a number of trees, and there's this little bird, a petite bird. It's brownish with white and maybe black on its head, and they are constantly running up and down the bark. And I was just curious what type of bird you might think that is. And then a second question, I've always wanted, I don't have a bird feeder, and I would love, I've heard your, what your ingredients are in yours. If you could just say that again so I can, I'd love to attract some, a variety of different birds to my yard. So I'd like to get yours and your guest's opinion on what a great or a good way to start with a bird feeder.
Okay. Well, and again, what size was that bird that you were talking about?
It's petite. It's half the size of my fist. So it seemed to run up and down the bark of the tree, maybe looking for insects.
Yeah, there's one thing that you described there in the behavior that really is key, and behavior happens to be step 7 in our book. And what you've seen is enough to actually identify this bird as a nuthatch. And a nuthatch is a kind of a relative of a woodpecker, but they're smaller and kind of a little bit more chunky. And there's two species, white-breasted and red-breasted nuthatches. And you might look those up in the book and see which one you have, but it sounds like you might have red-breasted if it's a little bit kind of orangey underneath with a darker cap.
Yes, they do. They do indeed. I will look that up. And any information on starting a bird feeder for someone who's never had one to attract colorful birds, I would appreciate it. I'll take your comments off the air. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So what's – go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, I was just going to say bird feeding I'm not an expert in bird feeding, but I do have some bird feeders at my house, and I've learned a few things over the years. One is that the long sort of tube-shaped feeders that you can get a nice mix of sunflower seed and different kinds of seed and put in those tube feeders tend to be generally good feeders for hanging. But I also have a platform feeder that I've built out of plywood that's really good for sparrows and things like that that are more apt to be closer to the ground or less comfortable coming up to those hanging tube feeders. I don't know, Larry, if you had any insight on that, but I also have a lot of hummingbird feeders at my house, which are always full.
Yeah, the hummingbird feeders are fun. And this time of the year in particular for the Orioles, you know, for $5 or so, you can buy one of these little Oriole feeders, which is essentially a platform with a little narrow roof over the top and typically with a couple of prongs off the side. And what I do is I get grape jelly and I put that in the little cup that goes in the center of the board. And then I take an orange and I cut it in half and I stick those halves on either side of the cup. And that is a... Not only will it attract Baltimore Orioles, but will also attract other birds as well who like to come and feed on the orange slices. They get all kinds of birds after those orange slices. And occasionally ants find their way to the jelly. So those are some tips. And it's always a lot of fun to have a couple, three, four feeders out there. Typically, they're not all that expensive. I happen to have an expensive one that is a tube type that's set up so that squirrels can't get at the bird seed. But that's like $90 or something. You can get, for a lot less money than that, you can set yourself up with some nice feeders for sure. Well, Alex in Rice Lake, your turn. Thanks for calling, Alex.
Hey, Larry. Love your show.
Thank you.
Hey, I had a question. I live up in Barron County, and a few days ago, there was a bird that I couldn't identify, and it just from the sound of it, it had multiple different types of calls, and it was about the size of probably like a grackle or so, but it was olive color. And I looked it up, and it said that maybe it was a northern mockingbird. And I was wondering if that was possible where I was located, or if you could help me out with maybe what kind of bird that was.
Well, Rice Lake is pretty far north. It would be on a line a little bit north of, if you were drawing a line across the country, north of Minneapolis a bit. Brian, what do you think?
Well, northern mockingbird is definitely one that fits the description, although they're not really olive color. They're sort of grayish above with, if you saw it fly, they have white wing patches and big white marks in the tail when they fly. But when they're perched, they can be sort of just an inconspicuous looking gray bird, but their voice is pretty phenomenal. They do a lot of mimicry and have constantly repeated six, usually part phrases that are groups of six. So I don't know if that sounds similar to what you were hearing or seeing. I can quickly pull up eBird and look and see if northern mockingbird is in your neck of the woods. And what was your county again?
It was Barron County.
Barron County. Yeah. Well, we'll take a look. Brian's going to take a quick look at that. And while he's looking at that, I'm going to remind you that Brian Sullivan is one of the authors. The other is Steve Howell, first author. Steve Howell and Brian Sullivan, and the book is The Peterson Guide to Bird Identification in 12 Steps. And we only got through a few steps. Brian, did you find anything out?
Yeah, I mean, it shows
could be.
It shows that northern mockingbird is, you know, scarce in Wisconsin in general, but you know, it's
possible.
Possibility.
Yeah, I have not seen one, but that's neither here nor there. It's a real pleasure to talk with you today, Brian. I hope we have a chance to do this again. I'm really enjoying your book, and we only got through a few of your 12 steps. So we'll have you back and we'll try and talk about some more. Thank you.
All right. Sounds great. Thanks for having me.
Brian Sullivan, co-author of Peterson Guide to Bird Identification in 12 Steps. Tomorrow we'll be live from our Wausau studios talking with Marge Gibson about rehabilitating wild birds and also about fishing. Stay with us.